Accession number 28657, Mr. Jeff King, Reel 9. Now, just finishing the Berlin raid, was there any, I mean, were you aware of what happened at the time? Because you've got lots of notes here about what happened, but, you know, did you, at the time, did you know the results of the Berlin raid?
Basically, from my memory, that particular raid wasn't not too bad. I think, remembering, there was about 8 to 9 tenths cloud over the target. But we were fortunate in being one of the first waves going through. We saw the ground marking, but subsequently they had to use sky marking. Well, now, with sky marking, sometimes it was very good, but it rather depended on the wind speed, because these sky markers were suspended on drogue-type chutes. And naturally, if there were high winds, they were blown off course. And so the actual bombing then was all over the place. But in numerous cases, they were quite successful, but they were rather a hit-and-miss affair.
The next thing then is, again, you went 2nd of December back to Berlin. And this is, there's a lot lost. There's a tenth of the bomber force were lost on this one. Do you remember this particular, it's 2nd of December, Berlin again? You probably, things seem to have gone a bit wrong. You lost the window and things like that.
Yes, very high winds. And the bomber stream was scattered extensively. And if I remember rightly, our route in was virtually straight in, straight out. But as I say, in view of the fact that there were very high winds, the bomber force were scattered all over the sky. And this again points to navigation, because with our navigator, he was immediately able to assess the fact that the winds that we had been given at briefing were not correct, and therefore was able to take into account the definite changes that had taken place. And again, this is where H2S came into its own, because one was able to get fixes which gave a fair indication of the fact that you were being blown off course. And Curley was able to rectify this by virtue of the fact that we were obtaining these fixes.
So you got there and bombed, presumably, your target, Berlin.
Yeah.
Now, on the way back, you were hit by anti-aircraft fire near Magdeburg. Tell us that story?
That was on the run into the target, actually.
On the run in, right? Sorry, yes.
We were just north of Magdeburg when we were hit by heavy anti-aircraft fire, and there was a hell of a noise as the shrapnel hit the underside of our bomb load, and the smell of the stench of explosive. I thought I'd been hit in my thigh, and I looked, and my navigator was lying with his head and arms outstretched on his nav table, and I thought, my God, he's bought it. But his oxygen mask had come adrift, and I managed to get that back on his face, and he came to again. He was perfectly okay. I likewise had not been hit. It must have been the suddenness of the anti-aircraft fire attack. I must have had an attack of cramp. But we went on and completed our raid, and it wasn't until we came back and were landing that our skipper suddenly realised that we had no brakes, and just managed to pull up as we reached the end of the runway. Well, next morning when we went down to have a look at our aircraft, There were numerous holes in it, but the largest of all, about the size of a football, was at the rear end of the aircraft and had missed air control, rudder controls, by only a matter of about 4 to 5 inches, and narrowly missing the Elson closet as well. That we just thanked our lucky stars that it had gone straight through us and hadn't hit these rudder controls, otherwise that would have been our lot. The other thing was that there was also a hole in the fairing of the inner port engine, and when that was taken off, there was a part missing on the reduction gear, and this had obviously fallen off once the engine had cooled. Now, there was never there was no indication at all that we'd been hit on any of the engines, and this engine, this inner port engine, had run absolutely perfectly. And I can only assume that this part of this casting of the reduction gear had remained in position until the engine cooled. And once it cooled, it fell out. But had it have gone into the gears, of course, that would have played merry hell with that engine.
How were you feeling? This is quite a close escape, one way or another. How did you feel about it? I mean, you'd been getting confident. You'd done a few raids by then. But
yes.
Did this affect your nerve, or how did you feel about it? Or did it make you feel more confident that the fact you got away with it?
Exactly. I was going to say, I think this was it. It didn't affect our run-in. The vital factor, and this is again where my experience as an engine fitter came into play, because one always knew if there was anything wrong with an engine. I could tell in a moment by the sound if any damage had been done to an engine. And you got that confidence that everything, as far as they were concerned, was okay. But I could tell in a moment if the pitch of that engine was not right. And that was one thing I acquired as an engine fitter.
Now, that's probably just a couple of general points. I forgot to ask, you mentioned the oxygen thing, reminding me. Could you tell us what you wore when you went up? What exactly, from your underpants upwards, in a sense? I mean,
yes.
What exactly was flying gear from top to bottom?
Well, we had fur-lined flying boots and jackets. I only ever wore the jacket and boots. I never wore a flying suit as such. My fur-lined jacket and boots were all I ever wore, and the same with our navigator. But the only chaps that were really and had to have more equipment were the gunners. The rear gunner had an electrically heated suit, and the mid-upper gunner was heated by the ordinary hot air circulation units within the aircraft.
Now, what about gloves?
So we were issued with little silk gloves, but I hardly ever wore gloves.
So you just, no gloves at all?
No gloves at all.
And on your head you had?
We wore a helmet, of course, where you had your intercom, airpieces, and an oxygen mask. You had various points within the aircraft where you plugged in to the oxygen supply. You also had emergency bottles. If one had to go for any reason or other to the back of the aircraft, here again, if one went to the toilet, you'd have to put on one of these little emergency bottles. Because any height over 10,000, you would suffer from oxygen lack. And in fact, our navigator, he wouldn't even have to reach 10,000 foot. He was very susceptible. But I could go up to 10 or 12. I always used to say, where there's no feeling, there's no sense.
And you'd also have your intercom in your helmet.
That's right, in the mouthpiece.
Which you didn't use much.
Which you only used as for instruction.
Now, where would you stash your parachute? Because you didn't wear it, did you?
No. Mine was in a housing in the nose of the aircraft. Each member of the crew had their own position to store their chute. The pilot, of course, had his he sat on his. That was part of his seat.
And was it possible to get it practice, putting it on quickly, that sort of thing?
Never had that that trouble. Never even went for mine in the plane, actually, at any time.
But had you practiced in case you had to?
Well, it was only a matter of clipping it on, two massive clips. You always wore your harness, by the way. Yeah. Once you were in a, from briefing, you put that on at briefing, at the finish of briefing.
So it was easy to...
All it was just two clips and whack, and it was on. Nothing complicated.
I just missed that. I should have put that in the earlier thing, but obviously I missed that out. I can't remember everything.
No.
Now, the next one was 20th of December, Frankfurt. An easier... Well, you'd been doing Berlin.
Yes, I think the main thing was we realised that you hadn't got the same defences. They were still concentrated, but... Berlin, of course, flying through Berlin took anything up to 25 to 30 minutes just to fly over the area, whereas most of these other cities were nowhere near the size of Berlin. And so you didn't look upon them quite in the same light as you would Berlin, although they had very active anti-aircraft defences. And not forgetting, of course, on all these targets you still had your night fighters to contend with.
It didn't go too well, that raid, I understand. The Pathfinders hadn't marked it. Well, cloud cover or some problem.
That's right, again. You nearly all these raids were planned for ground marking. But, of course, the precaution was always taken that should there be cloud, then a certain number of these aircraft were equipped with the air marking. Wanganui, they were called, funnily enough. And as I said earlier, these type of raids all hinged on the wind speed over the target. And of course, the size of the area that were being covered.
Now, the next one was back to Berlin, and this time your engine catches fire. This is on the 22nd of December. This is quite a story, or it is in your memoirs. What do you remember of it as it happened?
Yes. Well, an engine fire was always of great concern, because one realised that if the fire went beyond the bulkhead, then you had limited time to get out. But we were very fortunate. I think if I remember rightly, in this particular case, Jochen, and here's where the flight engineer comes in, it's a coordination between pilot and flight engineer, they got the fire under control. And within minutes of the fire being put out, the other inner engine suddenly cut out. So there we were, just on two engines. There was virtual silence in the aircraft, and our skipper came over and he said, well, there's every possibility that we may have to ditch in the North Sea. What do you want to do? Shall we bail out here? We were just on the German-Dutch border at that time, and unanimously we said, let's go on. And as luck would have it, we managed to make base, but we were well behind the rest of the bomber stream, but we made it. And that was just before Christmas, if I remember rightly, and we made up for it.
Celebrated.
What
were the Christmas celebrations like? I mean, what did you do on Christmas, December the 1943?
Well, the mess... we always had good food in the mess. And there were exceptional parties when, like Christmas came along, you had all the traditional food. plus anything else that the catering officer could find. And I must admit, at East Kirkby, we had an exceptional catering officer. Even to the point of having smoked salmon and salmon, fresh salmon. Where in heaven's name he got that at that particular time, God only knows. But apart from the normal mess, there was, as I say, it was exceptional, basically the food and the celebration.
Would the officers but serve the men? Did they have any of that old tradition?
Yes, certain members of the officers were allocated to the airman's mess and the sergeant's mess. I always escaped that duty.
Now, what's the next thing you remember? I mean, they're starting to change their tactics slightly. I mean, different routes, diversionary raids. Can you comment on the changes in tactics? Even in your tour, they're starting to change tactics,
yes,
aren't they?
Yes. Well, it became obvious that with the German fighter activity, that changes had to be made to the target approach, which meant, as you so rightly pointed out, a change of route. And not only a route, but routes. It could amount to anything, up to four or five different routes heading to a particular target, particularly Berlin. Which meant, of course, that where normally a straight in and a straight out run would be 6 to 7 hours, it could be 8 to 9 hours. It made all that difference. But it also confused the enemy defences, because in 9 cases out of 10, the Germans knew when there was going to be a raid. In fact, when we used to go up on our flight tests in the morning and the wireless operators tested their equipment, the Germans could pick up those transmissions, so they knew there were going to be a raid that evening, but they never knew, of course, where it was going to be. But they were already then on standby. And by virtue of the fact that we then used alternative routes into the target, they didn't always know quite where we were going. Coupled with the fact that we had spoof raids, where you'd got a certain number of aircraft would bomb an alternative target. And here's where some of the Mosquito squadrons came in. They would go to the alternative targets and bomb, give the impression that we were going to a particular target because we'd be heading in that direction. Then suddenly we would divert away from that particular target and go completely different, in a different direction.
Now, the next raid, New Year's Day, no hangover, I presume. You're on your way to Berlin again, and then again on the 2nd. Do you remember them one by one? I mean, the raid on the 1st, anything particular? There's nothing, I can't see anything particular about that.
No, I can't. The weather, of course, was one of the things we came up against at that particular time. If I remember rightly, on I think it was the 2nd, it was snowing like hell when we were detailed to go. And on the route, we ran into foul weather. And I think I think it was 4 Group were more concerned than we, and many of their aircraft turned back. But we pressed on, and I think there was a hell of a lot of icing, which was one of the biggest hazards. And the most frightening thing was when ice formed on your air screw, and then it reached a certain point and then come off and hit the side of the aircraft with a terrific whack. Icing, yes. There was icing and very, very high cloud, and one wondered when the hell we were going to get to the top.
And carry on, sorry.
As I say, once we broke through the cloud and through, we saw the stars, we were more than pleased. But it was the icing was the main problem. You could never touch the side of an aircraft under those conditions, or your fingers would stick. Because there was no insulation, of course, in the aircraft at all. It was just metalled, and that was it.
Now, the next rate is quite interesting, because you were allowed to not take it off, but you were allowed not to go. This is on the raid on Brunswick, because of a cold. You were allowed to miss raids, and if you were ill, as long as you weren't a regular. I mean,
the point was I could hardly talk. And I was so full of cold that it was quite obvious that I'd be more of a liability than any use to the crew.
And I presume if you made a habit of this kind of thing, you had to have a specific thing wrong with you.
Oh, yes. I had to see the MO, and it was he that decided that I shouldn't go. The congestion I had, as I say, would created a bigger problem.
So it's not a question of you saying, "Oh, I don't feel well, I'm not going."
No, I think if one tried that on, you wouldn't have to try it on many trips before you'd be questioned as to whether or not you were suffering from LMF.
LMF being?
Lack of moral fibre.
Was that a worry for people? Not for you? I mean,
no.
Were you aware of it?
Aware of it, but not... I didn't know anyone personally. There were members of crews that were removed and alternative pods put in, but I can't say that I could name a particular crew where it happened, but it did happen.
Was it common?
No. I think there had to be very good reason before a chap would end up with that problem.
Now, you went on a raid on your 21st birthday. That's quite amusing, on the 20th of January 1944, 20th, 20th, 21st, you know. Yeah. Do you remember that raid? What was it like going on a raid on your birthday? Your 21st birthday?
In fact, it was my 22nd.
I've got it wrong in the
record.
What did you think?
Well, I didn't give it a thought. To be quite honest with you, throughout my life, I've never really wanted to remember my birthday. The years fly by too quickly anyway. But I think we had the usual little celebration afterwards.
But nothing about the particular...
Nothing in particular, no.
Now, and again on Berlin, the 21st, there doesn't seem to be much about it there. And then the 27th, I don't know whether, 27th, your engine caught fire. Should we talk?
Yes. Again, I think this is one where it caught fire whilst we were over Holland, just approaching the German border. And we'd got a very heavy bomb load that night. I think we were carrying a fair number of explosive, high explosive. And we were, once the engine caught fire, George and Jock got the thing under control, but we couldn't maintain height. So it was quite obvious that it was no good us trying to go on with the rest of the bomber stream, because we were just losing height and losing speed all the time. So we turned, and when we cut over the centre of the Zuider Zee, I jettisoned the load. In fact, we were very lucky on that night, because the Germans had put up quite a large fighter force over the North Sea. So we were lucky not to meet up with that on our return.
Now, 28th, yet another raid on Berlin, and this time there's a sort of huge explosion. I noticed this story in particular.
Yes.
Tell me what happened here, because it must have been terrifying. Tell us what happened.
It was. We had just come out of the target and taken our course, our first course out, when suddenly on the starboard side there was one hell of an explosion, which looked like a firework display. Suddenly, we were just dropping from the sky, exactly like being in a lift, completely out of control. There was nothing one could do. I was still in the front position. and I was lifted, literally. Support my backside was supported by the front turret, and eventually we came to the end of this situation, and we were still flying straight and level. And our skipper said, "My God, what the hell was that?" At the time, we thought it was a German scarecrow flare.
A what?
A scarecrow flare.
And what was that?
Well, there were several of these situations that obviously others had been involved in, but we were under the impression that the Jerrys were firing up these massive flares that were bursting, giving the impression of an exploding aircraft, which in fact is what was happening. It was an aircraft actually being hit and exploding. And this was a case in point.